from the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
If you aren't curious about how a global pandemic started, willing to look into it and willing to talk to people who have different theories, you have not a single curious bone in your body, and you should really not be in journalism.
This is your host, Scott Bertram, and that's Molly Hemingway, our first guest on today's program. Molly is Senior Journalism Fellow at Hillsdale, also a Senior Editor at The Federalist, a Fox News contributor, and more. We talked at length with Molly about journalism today and her forthcoming book, Rigged: How the Media, Big Tech, and the Democrats Seized Our Elections. More on that in a little bit. Find her on Twitter at MZ Hemingway. Molly, great to have you back.
It is wonderful to be here with you.
Want to talk a little about journalism today and some recent stories. There's a piece at The Federalist we'll return to in a little bit. It's important to be honest about what today's media actually are. We'll return to that question in a moment. But there's been, just in the past 2 weeks or so, so many stories that damage the credibility of our news media as if that were still possible. The Brian Stelter interview on CNN with Jen Psaki, the White House press secretary, is uniquely awful. If people did not see this, and it's on CNN, so they probably didn't, but the White House press secretary comes on for an interview, Brian Stelter, reliable sources, CNN, media critic. The very first question that he asks Jen Psaki is, what does the press get wrong when covering Biden's agenda? When you watch the news, when you read the news, what do you think we get wrong? It's usually a question you'd ask a boss. In this case, it's the White House press secretary being asked this question, and it's something you could never imagine, ever imagine, anyone asking any of President Trump's press secretaries. What do we do wrong? How can we do a better job covering your administration? That would simply never happen.
That is the precise issue, that it wouldn't. It's not a question that you saw asked during the Trump administration. It's not a great question, obviously. It wouldn't necessarily be the worst question in the world if CNN and Brian Stelter had the same approach toward every press secretary, regardless of which administration they were in. But it wasn't just that they never asked anything like that of Kayleigh McEnany or the other press secretaries President Trump had. It's that they were cartoonishly hostile, never even giving a moment of good faith toward these press secretaries or anyone in the Trump administration. And then the moment Joe Biden is elected, it returns to what we saw during the Obama era of loyalty and fealty to these administration officials and a willingness to accept whatever they say and just a general niceness in how they treat these people. And it's not just that this is too nice for a legitimate journalist to be this way. It's also that it's in the context of just horrific hostility and crazy making and lying for year after year after year. And then when a Democrat is in office, it's exactly the opposite. And it's that approach that is untenable for a free people and a republic like ours.
If we throw into the mix now the lab leak story, Senator Tom Cotton, many others pilloried by the press, by the media, for bringing up the possibility that the COVID coronavirus could have been a lab leak in China. This is one of those stories that points to perhaps, in my mind, a total lack of curiosity on behalf of so many members of the media who are less likely to investigate, less likely to entertain things that simply don't conform to an existing narrative. Is there a problem with a lack of intellectual curiosity on behalf of many of our media members?
Scott, if you aren't curious about how a global pandemic started, one that has killed millions of people, sickened tens of millions more, utterly destroyed many major economies. I mean, this country, we are still down 7 to 8 million jobs since this began. If you're not curious about how that started and willing to look into it and willing to talk to people who have different theories, you have not a single curious bone in your body, and you should really not be in journalism. And it really shows how much people are willing to suppress that natural curiosity for partisan political aims. you know, they then also said that the reason why they messed up this story wasn't because of some personal failing, but because the theory had been talked about by Republican politicians like Mike Pompeo, Donald Trump, Tom Cotton, and so they just sort of reflexively opposed it. They took sources that were denying this like likelihood or strong possibility that the Wuhan Institute of Virology that was working on this coronavirus might have had something to do with it being unleashed on the world. They took certain sources and took them as more credible than the sources who were skeptical. And then they did this thing where they twisted what people were actually saying in order to debunk claims that weren't made. So they would say Tom Cotton was saying that China had engineered a biological weapon to unleash on the world. Well, he never said anything like that. He was saying, I think we need to look into the Wuhan Institute of Virology. But if you make the claim more dramatic than it was, it's easier to debunk it. So there were just multiple media failures here all across the board.
Molly Hemingway is with us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Find her on Twitter at MZ Hemingway. Her piece at The Federalist from a couple of months ago now, but it still rings true, of course. It's important to be honest about what today's media actually are. The subhead says they are Democrat propagandists and should be treated as such. You write in here, assume out of the gate that the narrative these leftist activists are pushing is not true. I don't know when this happened for you. I will tell you very clearly when it happened for me was during the 2016 election, probably sometime in the middle of the year, probably after the nominees were essentially known, that any tweet, any report from the New York Times, Washington Post, ABC, NBC, CBS, I simply assumed was not true. I simply assumed that perhaps not the opposite was true, but what they were saying was not the entire story. In some ways, it made me a better media consumer because I had to go seek out original sources. I had to go find other points of view because I knew what was being reported was quite likely not going to be accurate. How should people deal with this assumption that the narrative is going to be contra what the truth is oftentimes?
First off, I just love hearing what it was that made people become better media consumers. And it's one of my favorite questions to ask people because you would be surprised at the wide variety of responses. And for me personally, it was the media treatment of Mitt Romney when he was running for president. Mm-hmm. I'm not even like a huge Mitt Romney fan, but he's such a nice guy. And the way they portrayed him as Hitler, I thought, if they're willing to do this with this guy, they're willing to do it with literally anyone that they perceive as a threat to their political interests. So I think it is a good step that most people actually understand. Studies show that there's not much trust in the media. And that's across the board. I mean, not even Democrats have that much trust. That's a good first step. But then the question is, yeah, what do you do? Do you still let them define the contours of the debate? Do you still read them and treat them as if they are legitimate? And I think that's a good next step for people. Don't call them mainstream media. They're not mainstream media. And they're propaganda for the most part. You might find a good journalist here or there who's willing to just report facts, but that's not what the general situation is with corporate media. And you need to stop relying on them for news or relying on them uncritically for news and stop supporting them and advertising with them and paying attention to them. And also, though, I think the big actors need to be a little bit more aware of what they need to do. So, for instance, if the media are no longer even trying to pretend to be caring about a shared set of facts but are just engaged in political activism, they should have no role in presidential debates. That's ludicrous to think that they would be considered to be moderators of any debate involving the party that they will do anything to support and the party that they will do anything to destroy. And powerful people like that need to stop treating them as if they are media when they're actually propagandists. Not a single conservative should go on one of these liberal networks or talk to a liberal newspaper without understanding that they are walking into a space where the people want to destroy them. Now, if they're prepared for that and they can handle that and they can work that to their advantage, that's one thing. But they shouldn't be acting like these people are operating in good faith when they have spent decades showing that they're not.
Molly, we'll pause right there when we come back. More on the state of journalism today and also a preview of Molly's forthcoming book, a couple of months away, but available for pre-order now. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. To find out more about Hillsdale College for prospective students, for friends of Hillsdale or alumni, head to hillsdale.edu. We've been talking with Molly Hemingway, Senior Journalism Fellow here at Hillsdale, also with The Federalist and a Fox News contributor, specifically about a recent piece for The Federalist titled, It's Important to Be Honest About What Today's Media Actually Are. I'm frustrated, and maybe others are too, by the aspect of accountability here. And there simply is none. You can go back to, we talked about the lab leak, the Lafayette Park story previously. One that sticks out very vividly from recent vintage is the 60-minute story on Ron DeSantis, where we know that they clipped out the entire portion of the governor's answer where he debunked the line of argument that 60 Minutes was making. We know that essentially it became a hit piece against the governor. And yet there are no consequences for the reporter. There are no consequences for 60 Minutes, for CBS. There is no apology. There is no retraction. There is nothing at all. It just hangs out there, and there are no consequences for these activities. Do you feel that is a deep source of frustration as well?
This is what is so, yes, frustrating about the current moment. You actually can go back to Eisenhower to find Republican presidents complaining about bias in the media. George H.W. Bush, when he ran for re-election, his bumper sticker that was most popular was, annoy the media, re-elect Bush. If you're still complaining about bias and not recognizing the absolute corruption of our media, you just belong back in the 1980s and not as a political actor in this state. You take 60 Minutes. I mean, when was it that Dan Rather published those made-up reports on George W. Bush?
Right.
You can't keep forgetting what they do and how they lie about everything. And part of the problem is that I think a lot of conservatives have internalized this idea that they deserve to be treated like second-class citizens. And that's not true. And they need to not tolerate the willful lying and defamation and falsehoods that are happening routinely from corporate media. So you're seeing some people start to push back. I think Ron DeSantis is actually excellent. I heard him say at an event recently something about how the media don't like him, but that's okay because he doesn't like them either. He just understands they're out. They sense that he is a very powerful person who could continue to expose them for who they are, and so they're focused on bringing him down. He gets it, and so he engages with them like that, and he's smart enough that when he was smart enough not to cooperate in the 60 Minutes hit piece on him because he knew where that was going, and it actually redounded in to some extent to his benefit. But 60 Minutes is still powerful, and we need again more powerful people to push back against the daily lies and misinformation that they're putting out. There's so much disinformation that just happens routinely. You referenced the Lafayette Park thing that lasted for more than a year. That actually led to a lot of people being afraid to restore law and order in their cities. Like, if you couldn't defend the White House, you certainly can't defend, you know, Joe Bob's store that's getting burned down in Kenosha. Mm-hmm. You can't, and it led to so many deaths and billions of dollars of damage. This is a powerful political actor, and people need to treat the corrupt media like the powerful political actors they are. They're unaccountable. They never admit error. They're never forced to deal with the damage they cause, even when it's like actual death and billions of dollars of damage. And people need to, basically every single member, I would say, of the conservative movement and anyone who just cares about the republic needs to aim decisively against corrupt media and the damage they're causing the country.
I've been kicking around a theory, Molly, that I'll share with you and get reaction in trying to explain what's going wrong, what's happening. And what I come up with is that a problem is that so many in the media give tweets the weight of stories, but they treat their stories as lightly as perhaps they should treat tweets. Stories are ephemeral. It's wrong today. It's not a big deal. We'll write a different story tomorrow. But tweets are forever. You tweet the wrong thing, you can be canceled. You can be fired. Things from 10 years ago matter today, even if you're a completely different person. You were 14 back then. You're 24 right now. It seems like the weight is placed upon these tweets, these 200-character things as opposed to the stories. The stories can be wrong, whatever. But the tweet can't be wrong.
That is such an excellent insight that I hope you write it up and flesh it out a little bit more. I would only add to it, though, that it's not entirely true that it's universally applied. And I'm thinking about how in the last week we learned that Hunter Biden used racist language mm-hmm. in texts, and I think foreign media reported on it. The U.S. media ignored it. But the U.S. media will put on the front page of the New York Times, just like what you said, a kid when she was 14 using the same word inappropriately and having her entire life destroyed. So there is such they don't even care that they're not applying the same standards across the board. If you're powerful and elite and with them politically, they will protect you at all costs. And if you are young, they will keep you in line. Or if you're young or disfavored politically, they will use the same things to keep them in line. But yes, the Twitter has been such a net negative for journalism, except that I think it has exposed just how lacking in intelligence and integrity many reporters are.
You might know Molly Hemingway from The Federalist or Fox News or here at Hillsdale, but of course also the author of the best-selling book Justice on Trial, The Kavanaugh Confirmation and the Future of the Supreme Court, co-author with Carrie Severino. There is a new book that is coming out soon, but people can find and pre-order your upcoming book, Rigged, How the Media, Big Tech, and the Democrats Seized Our Elections. Give our listeners a bit of a preview of what's to come in Rigged.
Yeah, I was just fascinated how people were talking about the election after it happened, where you got these two extreme positions. Either you were told that even though there had been radical changes to the way we conduct elections in terms of a massive increase in mail-in balloting, which has traditionally been associated with a lack of scrutiny or an opportunity for fraud, that this was the most pure and decent and best election in history, and anyone who says otherwise is a liar. And then on the other hand, you had people trafficking in some pretty extreme conspiracy theories about, you know, Venezuela taking over voting systems and things like that. The vast majority of Republican voters did not feel like this election was conducted in a completely free, fair way. And I wanted to look into that and looking at how there are many different ways they look at that, whether it was what we just have been talking about, corruption by the media, where they lied about President Trump or other Republican candidates or failed to cover stories that were critical of their opponents, polling that was seemingly so out of touch with reality that it was questionable about the effect it had on the election, such as saying that Donald Trump would lose Wisconsin by 17 points, as the Washington Post said just days before the election, and the final tally was less than 1%, or tech companies suppressing conservative information and thought, or these changes to election laws, which for me, what was most interesting is it's allowed this very big liberal nonprofit, all these entities to kind of come into our electoral system. So I do a deep dive into all of this stuff and look at it and kind of separate out the crazy theories from what actually happened and looking at what needs to happen going forward.
That is coming up in Rigged, How the Media, Big Tech, and the Democrats Seized Our Elections, available for pre-order now from Molly Hemingway, senior editor at The Federalist, senior journalism fellow at Hillsdale College, Fox News contributor. Find her also on Twitter at MZ Hemingway. Molly, thank you so much for joining us once again here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you, Scott.
Up next, Sohrab Ahmari will join us from the New York Post, whose book is The Unbroken Thread. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
What is a hero? A hero serves when no one else is ready to. A hero helps everyone, never asking for any praise. They stand ready to do whatever is needed. They have picked up the mantle of heroism when we have needed it the most, and their tireless dedication can never be appreciated enough. We want to thank all of our local heroes. We could not get through these times without their courage. We thank you for everything that you do.
Since 1890, Stifel has established itself as one of the nation's leading wealth management and investment banking firms by understanding clients' hopes and dreams, focusing on building and preserving wealth. Simply put, when you achieve your goals, we achieve ours. I'm proud to be a part of Stifel as a financial advisor. This is Susan Eastman, First Vice President Investments. Call today for quality time well spent. 530-244-7199. Again, 530-244-7199.
celebrate the Papa Bear in your life. The popular Big Daddy Burger is back at Black Bear Diner. This massive burger sports 2 10-ounce patties and a 6-inch sesame seed bun. Add 2 onion rings, a fried egg, bacon, cheese, pickles, lettuce, tomato, mayo, and dressing, and well, you've got a burger challenge. Want the Big Daddy but can't tackle the mountain? Try the new Little Daddy. Get both this month only at Black Bear Diner on Hilltop Drive in Redding, or order for carryout or delivery at blackbeardiner.com.
Black Bear Diner.
30 years ago, Simpson University arrived in Redding with a promise to serve the North State. Warmly welcomed by this far Northern California community, we forged lasting partnerships, serving our neighbors locally as well as globally. Building on our promise, Simpson University now offers over 20 degree programs. Our promise to be the gateway to world service begins in our backyard. Learn more about Redding's hometown university at simpsonu.edu.
On over for savings at Quick and Clean Car Wash at the corner of Market and Eureka Way next to Dutch Bros in downtown Redding. Buy 5 car wash coupons and get 1 free. Or buy 10 and get 3 free. Quick and Clean is a family-owned business. They offer only the highest quality service. Quick and Clean Car Wash at the corner of Market and Eureka Way next to Dutch Bros in downtown Redding. Quick and Clean.
Aloha. This is Kevin, operations manager at Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. A professionally cleaned business sends a message to your paying customers. It says you are a company that cares about your image and always presenting the very best impression. Time after time, I've talked to clients who shopped for the lowest price and after a few months realized that their professional image was suffering. They didn't know who was actually coming into their offices to do the cleaning, and they just weren't getting the value they were paying for. Be wary of big-name companies that take your money, then hire unknown contractors to do the work. Since 1987, Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, your local professionals, have been offering the best in office cleaning by our screened, bonded, and insured staff. Take pride in your business and say aloha to your customers with the professional cleaning services from Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. Call 221-5868, 221-5868, MauiBob'sOfficeCleaning.com.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. We're joined by Sohrab Ahmari. He's op-ed editor at the New York Post, a columnist over at First Things, a contributing editor at the Catholic Herald, and he has a brand new book out, The Unbroken Thread, Discovering the Wisdom of Tradition in an Age of Chaos. Sohrab, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Scott.
I want to ask at the beginning, the difference for you between knowledge and wisdom, as it says in your subhead of the book, how do you delineate those two, and why is wisdom more important?
I guess I would say knowledge is a subset of wisdom or a building block of wisdom, but it's not the sum of wisdom. I opened the book with a chapter about C.S. Lewis. The book as a whole is structured around 12 unasked questions that I argue our society doesn't pay attention to or mistakenly believes have been answered or have been cast aside by the rise of modern science or what have you, whereas in fact they're very pertinent questions. And each question is explored through the life of one great thinker, because I'm not a theologian or a philosopher, I'm just a storyteller and a journalist of ideas. And the first chapter has to do with precisely the question you asked. The figure at the center of it is C.S. Lewis and his critique of scientism. And it has to do with the difference really between the way I frame it instead of knowledge and wisdom is more about facts and truth. Hmm. It's only roughly the past 400 years in the kind of moral and intellectual history of our species that we came to equate facts with truth or facts with wisdom. And the danger in that is that all sorts of other dimensions of life that contain wisdom for us, for example, our premonitions, our feelings, religious thought, literature, poetry, all of these come to be treated as secondary or provisional or less important and unreliable. And so I argue that that impoverishes us as a people, as the American people, as moderns.
You mentioned each chapter here asks a question: is God reasonable? What do we owe our parents? And then answers it with a biographical sketch of a thinker on that topic. I just want to spend time on one other before we get to some bigger questions, and that's the chapter on Victor Turner. Can you be spiritual without being religious? How do you attack that question?
Yeah, Scott, as you probably have heard, about 20% of Americans now claim to be spiritual but not religious. That is, they believe they have some access to a spiritual realm that they can access on their own without the need for the traditional instruments and, more important, the rituals that we associate with religion, all kind of major religions, but also smaller ones. What I argue in that chapter is that the problem with spiritual but not religious isn't that it is the religion side of it, it's the spirituality side of the ledger, because traditional religions combine ritual with shared public meanings about the ultimate meaning of life. So, for example, when you go to church, you do certain ritualistic things. If you're Catholic, you cross yourself when you enter, you do certain things, you do a rite of penance at the beginning of the Mass, and so on and so forth. But then you share that with other believers and a faith in some ultimate meaning of life that you get from the Catholic faith or the Muslim faith or the Jewish faith. The people who claim to be spiritual but not religious do all sorts of ritualistic things. They do yoga on their own, or they go spinning, or they only eat, drink, you know, certain kind of restorative juices on Fridays or what have you. So they have the ritual aspect, or maybe the rituals of public shaming on Twitter is a kind of ritual itself, but they don't have a shared account of ultimate meaning, and therefore their spirituality is unserious.
Sir Abba Mari is with us. The Unbroken Thread is his new book, Discovering the Wisdom of Tradition in an Age of Chaos. I know you began work on this book a couple of years ago and put it to bed in the middle of 2000, if I'm not mistaken. You could not have predicted some of these things that have been happening between lockdowns and losing our ties to constitutional order, statues being torn down, history classes being rewritten on the fly to exclude certain lessons, certain people. We are becoming quickly untethered to these past traditions. Why does it seem that we are accelerating in this direction?
Well, that's a great question, Scott. So I should note that I wrote this book for my son. He's now 4 years old. When I started, which was before the pandemic, in the before times, he was 2 years old. And the reason I started writing it was because I was, you know, deeply worried, frankly, about what kind of a man our current civilizational arrangements would chisel out of him. What I'm worried about is that our civilization formed elites to be incredibly selfish and self-gratifying and self-seeking, and it makes it incredibly difficult for ordinary people to live decent, virtuous American lives as they used to do. That the world that came about was brought about in the name of liberation. The kind of left establishment and the right establishment together, without really asking the American people whether this is the world they wanted, gave us this world, and they promised to liberate us. They said that by overcoming our ancient traditions, our Judeo-Christian and classical traditions that informed American life, we would be freer and happier. Only in retrospect do we see that those traditions that guided people and restrained their appetites and told us that there is such a thing, for example, as objective truth about the differences between men and women, those traditions were not sources of oppression. That's what was keeping us free, sane, and happy. So the book is this defense of tradition in a broad sense, as what looks to be something that's restrictive is actually liberating.
I want to spend another minute on that, and if I just summarize the argument a bit, it's living within traditional limits can liberate us. Unending liberty in many ways imprisons us in a way. If that's true, that's a choice, though, a choice to continue to live within those traditional limits. How do you convince people to do that?
Well, I mean, part of it is the project of writing the book. For me as a father, it's an act of posterity for my son to try to inoculate him against what he'll be told, no doubt, in probably the schools he'll attend or our wider culture, to tell him that everything traditional is icky and all your ancestors were basically morons and everything new is best. Whatever is newest is best. It's kind of what C.S. Lewis called chronological snobbery or presentism. I'm trying to inoculate that as a father, but I also think that public policy plays a role. That is, traditionalist political actors, broadly speaking, and in our society, what tradition is a little bit more contested. We're a pluralistic society, but nevertheless, you can argue that an Orthodox Jew shares more with an evangelical Christian and with a devout Roman Catholic than either of them, and even a Muslim, and than either of them does with a kind of woke liberal. therefore, traditionalist political actors have to seek to restore some of these traditions, including enshrining them in law, where they've been needlessly abolished. So one kind of provocative argument that I make is the restoration of the Sabbath as an American institution. So as you know, America had Sabbatarianism, with Sabbath laws, going to the colonial era, so before the founding of the Republic. In colonial New England, but also in supposedly more secular colonial Virginia, in New Amsterdam, the Dutch had. And what was that about? They told us that getting rid of it, and when I say they, I mean the kind of Chamber of Commerce establishment, right, told us getting rid of it would mean more choice, more freedom. You could do whatever you want with your time. And you don't have to be, as a religious person, you don't need a Sabbath. Well, in practice, that's not how it worked out. Because it turns out the Sabbath wasn't just about honoring God, as important that is, honoring him in his creation, in his gift of creation, and setting aside some time for non-acquisitiveness, non-competition, but more being with God, being with Scripture, being with family, but also protected workers. The institution of the Sabbath is a kind of barrier against relentless work, and the loss of it has made us more harried and more miserable.
Sohrab Ahmari, The Unbroken Thread is the new book, Discovering the Wisdom of Tradition in an Age of Chaos. Sohrab, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Scott.
Up next, we talk with Ben Beyer from Hillsdale's Education Department, returning for his occasional series on definition. Today we talk technical definition. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
KCNR, 96.5 FM, AM 1460, and online at am1460.com. Don't miss Free Fire Radio weekday mornings from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. with Carl and Linda Bott. From 9 to noon, be informed and laugh along with Armstrong and Getty, the conscience of the nation. From noon to 3, find your financial peace with Dave Ramsey. From 3 to 6, don't miss constitutional expert Mark Levin. Monday through Thursday night, starting at 6 p.m., we have local shows featuring everything from the paranormal to riding routes, pop culture, and unsung heroes in the North State. From 7 to 10, tune into Ben Shapiro with an expanded program that brings the issues of the day to your radio. KCNR also has an incredible weekend lineup, including The Plotline, Jefferson State of Mind, Sovereign Minds, and We the People on KCNR 96.5 FM, AM 1460, and online at kcnr1460.com.
A building that's meant to last is not built overnight. And for centuries, the cornerstone has been crucial to guide each brick and wall that comes after. A strong community relies on many cornerstones. So at Cornerstone Community Bank, we've taken our name to heart. Whether it's your business or your family, we'll provide the financial cornerstone that you need to build on. We're local. We're community. We're your cornerstone. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Every Monday from 6 to 8 p.m., join us at Radio Wasteland, your local guide to the unexplained and the unknown. Each week, we cover all things unexplained, from the moving stars in the sky to the things that go bump in the night. Visit us as we explore these topics and more as our in-studio team digs deeper with featured guests and listener call-ins. Mondays are rough, but now your overworked brain has a chance for some sweet relief with Radio Wasteland.
Radio Wasteland, Mondays at 6 on KCNR.
Alan Gordon, Coachmaster Collision. Although Coachmaster is recognized as the authority and specialist in frame and suspension, we are primarily your auto body and truck collision repair center. This includes all vehicles, Lexus, Honda, or pickup trucks. Our technicians are highly trained and have the most advanced equipment to ensure a complete and quality repair. With our knowledge in the insurance claim process, all we need is your claim number to handle your claim. Coachmaster has a great working relationship with all insurance companies. This ensures a complete repair with quality parts and a delay-free process. At Coachmaster, in our 50 years in business, we've experienced almost every situation imaginable in a claim. This experience and personal dedication to the repair of your vehicle sets Coachmaster apart from all other choices. And yes, if we can't fix it, no one can.
Learn more online at CoachmasterAutobody.com.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. You can get an email every time there's a new episode of the program. Head to radiohour.hillsdale.edu and enter your email address. That's radiohour.hillsdale.edu. We also invite you to find the show on Twitter, at Hillsdale Radio. We're joined by Dr. Benjamin Beyer, Associate Professor of Education at Hillsdale College. Dr. Beyer, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Continuing our occasional series on definition with Dr. Beyer, last time we talked non-technical definitions, so on the flip side, let's talk technical definitions this time around. Where do we begin?
Sounds great. So there's four types of technical definition, sometimes called logical definition, and sort of let me list them in order from that which is sort of least precise, or we might say least helpful to most. Definition by accident, by property, essential definition, and definition by cause. And so today I'd like to look at the first two, definition by accident and by property.
So let's start. Definition by accident. But that sounds totally happenstance. Like, we don't even know how it happened. It just is defined.
Well,
I'm sure it's not quite the case.
Well, see, we haven't defined accident, Scott.
That's true.
There actually is something to what you're saying. So, you know, we have that which we're seeking to define. You know, let's say dog. You know, what's the very essence or nature of the dog? Again, taking a simple example, though this can help us with more complicated concepts in our lives. And so if we say, you know, a dog is domesticated is an accident because it's not unique to a dog,
mm-hmm.
right? Cats are domesticated, lots of things are domesticated. So it's a mere accident in a slightly different sense of the word accident. But, you know, sometimes accidents are starting us on the right track to the thing's very essence. You know, like, if we say of the human being ten-fingered, well, you know, for instance, if a human being is born with nine fingers or loses a finger in an accident, the person is no less human. So it's accidental.
Right.
And yet, it is kind of cutting away. Well, there are animals with no fingers. There are animals with not 10 fingers. Right? That's sort of just nudging us towards what the human being is. But to go back to dog, then, right, if you don't quite know what a dog is, you can start to collect multiple accidents together.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, okay, a dog is carnivorous and domesticated. And, okay, well, does that cut away everything that's not dog? Not quite. Right. If you say, right, carnivorous, domesticated, and able to bark, like there, maybe we have actually achieved an accidental definition because those three accidents in combination, none of them are the essential thing of dogness.
Mm-hmm.
But together, it at least sort of identifies what's unique to dog, though, right. It seems that in the 20th century, the Soviets actually successfully domesticated some foxes in a way that might trouble this definition by accident. But that's the great thing, right? Is sort of, if you understand definition by accident, then you're looking for a fourth accident to even cut away the, right? Sort of like, oh, you know, do those dogs all have pointy ears? Or excuse me, do all those foxes have pointy ears and dogs don't? Maybe you can find the fourth thing.
Yeah.
If you understand how it works.
I'm kind of picturing in my mind like a big giant Venn diagram, right?
So yeah, absolutely.
There are a bunch of accidents, but the dog in our case is right at the center and contains all of them.
No, that's very good. And a lot of logicians like to use Venn diagrams, and some resist them for reasons that's not worth getting into here. But I think you're right on point, Scott.
And the other one, by property. So definition by property, what do we mean by that?
Yeah, so a property, and property, gets defined in different ways. Sometimes a property is just that which belongs to every instance of a thing you're trying to define, like all zebras are striped. And sometimes a property isn't just common to every instance of the thing. Sometimes it's something that is unique to that thing. So that, right, human beings, for example, right, if you're trying to define what is a human being, you say, well, a human being is, you know, able to make art, is able to prepare his or her own food, is able to learn grammar, is able to argue about right and wrong. Like, those are property in the more narrow sense, because those arguably belong to every human being and only human beings always. Now, again, I can imagine the listener maybe saying, sort of, well, that doesn't belong just to human being. You know, I don't know if I even said one of the traditional properties of human being is ability to laugh. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the listener might say, I've been to the zoo, Dr. Beyer. You know, I've seen the chimpanzees cackling and throwing their poop. I've seen the hyenas, you know. And so there we need a definition of what ability to laugh means. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would submit that sort of what human laughter is different. So anyway, you've found this thing that's utterly unique, and you can say, okay, so man, human being, is the animal that's not a property, but sort of a general thing that belongs to man and other things. You know, human being is the animal with the ability to laugh and prepare its own food. We've got all these properties, and so that's a really good definition, because you've got these things that are totally unique to human beings.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason why it's property, as opposed to one we'll talk about next time, the essential definition, is you have this lingering sense that there's something causing that, right? That there's something behind the human ability to laugh or make art or prepare food, and these are just effects or results of something more fundamental or deeper. And so, right, it's a different type of definition altogether when you find that cause, that deeper thing. A lot of times we'll begin with a definition by property. Well, a lot of times we'll begin with accident and mm-hmm. then maybe get to property and then get to something better. And I think there's really good instances in the hard sciences where, you know, maybe an experiment will reveal something about hydrogen that's unique to hydrogen, but then it takes generations of reflection and work to find why
right.
that's the case.
We have a moment here, and as we continue through this series, we'll have one more part in this series on definition. Are we merely describing different ways to get to definition, or are we in a way working toward ways to have a better definition?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think we're kind of doing both. That is, in the various parts of the series, we've given, right, lots of different types of definition or ways of defining that, on the one hand, is a toolbox, right? Many different ways to approach defining something. But the order of the series has suggested that some definitions are stronger than others, so that we're kind of, you know, ascending up from just kind of words and synonyms with today's visit, and then right next time we'll be at the height.
Mm-hmm.
Though, you know, as I was suggesting with the hydrogen example a moment ago, the height, it's not sort of, you know, you're having this disagreement at the dining room table and you say, let's get our terms straight, let's define so we're not talking past each other. It doesn't mean that sort of there that evening in the next 10 minutes you're gonna, you know, find the sort of the strongest definition. So it's a bit of a both and. Lots of strategies, lots of ways to define, but some better getting at the heart of the matter.
Dr. Benjamin Beyer, Associate Professor of Education at Hillsdale College, talking about definition here in our occasional series, Technical Definitions Today. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Beyer, here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
It's a pleasure. Thanks.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Molly Hemingway, a senior journalism fellow at Hillsdale College, senior editor at The Federalist. We talked about the current state of the media. It also previewed her upcoming book, Rigged, How the Media, Big Tech, and the Democrats Seized Our Elections. We also talked with Sohrab Ahmari, his recent book, The Unbroken Thread, Discovering the Wisdom of Tradition in an Age of Chaos, and Ben Beyer from Hillsdale's Education Department, as we talked about technical definition. The Radio Free Hillsdale Hour is recorded at the studios of WRFH, the student-run radio station at Hillsdale College. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews, including our Sohrab Omari interview this week, on the podcast. Find that at SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, TuneIn, Stitcher, Spotify, or Amazon Podcasts. Search for The Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Follow us on Twitter at Hillsdale Radio or find us on Facebook. Email us at radiohour@hillsdale.edu. To find out more about Hillsdale College, head to hillsdale.edu. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been The Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Are you enjoying the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour? Then sign up for the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour email list. Just visit radiohour.hillsdale.edu and type in your email address to receive the latest episodes with interviews of Hillsdale College professors and friends. Again, don't miss an episode and join our email list at radiohour.hillsdale.edu. That's radiohour.hillsdale.edu.
Remodeled kitchen, bathroom, or backyard patio? There's a lot of choices, but only one leader, Estate Granite.
Mike Huber has such a professional attitude and a can-do work ethic that makes him a joy to work with. Mike and his crew worked to have our new kitchen finished in 5 days. We came back to a true work of art.
Hi, this is Brian Filato, broker and co-owner of The Real Estate Group. In today's competitive market, I think what's important is that the house is dialed in and turnkey. And what's important is that the kitchen has been renovated, the bathrooms have been renovated, granite, beautiful cabinetry. Those things make a significant difference.
Mike at Estate Granite has an eye for detail, an attention to perfection, and a quality build crew that are masters of their craft. Mike was there from start to finish.
Hi, this is Mike from Estate Granite. I know how important quality to a homeowner is, so give me a call at 241-STONE or come by our showroom at 4900 Mountain Lakes Boulevard or visit us at EstateGranite.com.
Founded in 1995, GI Pathology is the only physician-owned laboratory in the United States dedicated solely to the practice of gastrointestinal and liver pathology. The company provides the highest quality GI pathology diagnosis made exclusively by one of our fellowship-trained gastrointestinal and liver pathologists. GI Pathology delivers results to its Northern California client base within an industry-leading 24 hours. Call 888-2-GI-PATH or go to www.gipath.com for more information.
For over 50 years, House of Realty has provided experienced and effective advice to its real estate clients. Experts in residential, commercial, and investment property, we have the knowledge and tools to assist you with all of your real estate needs. Family owned and operated since 1965, we have been an active part of the Shasta County community for generations. Please call House of Realty today at 241-8300, a reputation for excellence since 1965.
This is Ted Leidy with Northern Firearms Instruction. Do you have a crazy schedule and can't seem to get to a class to qualify for your CCW, CCW renewal, or maybe learn to use that new firearm you just purchased? Consider a private class with NFI. Learn to shoot a handgun, rifle, shotgun, or even a BB gun. Classes are taught by an instructor that you choose on your dates and location. Give NFI a call at 530-999-1822 or visit us online at usgunpro.com. This is Ted Leidy, and I'll see you at the range.
These are unprecedented times. Challenging how the YMCA works to strengthen community as we have for nearly 170 years. But we've always found ways to help people and communities in times of crisis. Right now, Ys across the country are providing emergency childcare, shelter, food programs, and outreach to seniors. But we can't do it alone. Whether you're connected to the Y or have a fond Y memory, we need you to stay with us. Reach out to your local Y today and stay with us. For a better us.
Where do you go in Shasta County to get advice on the best type of firearm to meet your needs and how to safely carry and use it? The answer is to join the revolution at locally owned Bastiani Arms. Bastiani Arms believes in a better way to serve their customers and providing them with all the information needed to make the right decisions before and after the sale. They have a large selection of guns and ammunition and always special discounts for veterans. Self-protection is your right. Join the revolution at Bastiani Arms, 2539 Larkspur Lane in Reading, 222-8222.
The best investment is in the tools of one's own trade.
Benjamin Franklin.
You're listening to Writing Roots, brought to you by Aspen House Publishing.
Welcome to Writing Roots. I'm Lee Hall.
And I'm Lee Esses.
Today's question is, what kind of software is best to use to write a book? And what about formatting that book?
My pastor has this saying. People would ask him all the time, what's the best version of the Bible? And his answer is always, the one you'll read. To answer this question, I would say the same thing. The one you'll actually write the book in.
The one you'll use. Every piece of software has its benefits, its negatives. You need to find the one that works for you.
We're approaching this question because we see it all the time. This episode, we are just talking about the different options that are out there, our experiences with them, so that you can know where to start in your own research.
So we'll be talking about software programs that help from the beginning to the end of the publishing process. Let's start with writing the book, the best software pieces to write the book. There are many, but the simplest ones are, of course, Microsoft Word, Google Docs, LibreOffice.
And my personal favorite, pen and paper.
Typewriter for funsies.
The non-writing world will automatically think Microsoft Word. That's what I do my typing in. That's what I am writing my essays for school in. That's going to be the default that a lot of people go to.
One problem with Microsoft Word, there is a cost. I personally don't like it because of that.
That's also why I use LibreOffice. It's a useful tool for people who are not wanting to be online constantly while they're writing, if you don't have great Wi-Fi or whatever where you are, but you want to get a bunch of text just on a page.
LibreOffice, Google Docs, Microsoft Word, they're all simple writing tools. I think Microsoft Word and Google Docs have basic spell check and grammar check designed into them. My biggest problem, though, aside from cost, is that you have to manually save. I prefer Google Docs personally because it auto-saves everything I do, and I won't lose my work.
A lot of people are asking about voice-to-text as well. If you're on a computer, the Dragon speech recognition software is one of the more popular ones.
Phones are a great resource for this. I know someone who has problems with their hands, so she writes almost solely through voice recognition on her phone to Google Docs.
There's one more name in this category that you're going to see fairly often, and that's Scrivener.
It's a little, I think, more advanced than your basic word processing. There's a few other different word processors like Scrivener, such as LivingWriter and a few others. These can be useful for someone who wants a little more advanced help, but it does come at a cost. If you know how to write, if you're comfortable with that, and you have resources to get a good editor, then getting an advanced word processing software isn't absolutely necessary. Scrivener is also good for people who want to do other kinds of writing than just novel or fiction writing. I have not personally used it because I have ways to do them that are free.
Last thing I want to mention in this category is a program called Celtix. C-E-L-T-X is specifically for screenwriting and stage writing. That might be one you check out.
So let's get into the next step. Once you've written the book, your next step is to edit the book. Whether you are editing on your own or with someone else, there are different resources that can help you in this process. My preference is Google Docs.
Google Docs is nice because you can both be involved in the project at the same time. And instead of seeing that little red line and then making the changes to reflect that, you can either accept or decline the suggestion.
So it is very useful. Now, if you don't trust your editor as much as we trust each other, then
find a different editor.
Or use Kami. Kami is a kind of plugin that allows you to do a lot of the same things with Google Docs of making comments and notes and suggestions on a PDF.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.